Mark chapter 8 is where we're at. Mark chapter 8. We're coming off of the clean, unclean issue. I know that was in chapter 7, but we were talking about yesterday how I think that that's still the conversation that's been moving. Because ultimately, the clean, unclean issue is about what? Jesus' identity. Who he is. Does he have the authority to be saying the things he's saying? And if he is who he says he is, the answer is yes. But if you don't know who he is, you're going to have a hard time with it, if not want to kill him. And that's what we saw with the Pharisees. We've also been talking about through the Gospel of Mark, the function of miracles. How do miracles function? Say it again. Peer pressure, is that what you said? What's it?
No, as a verification of his identity.
Yeah, a verification of what he says. The deeds and the words, they function in a sense in which the deeds are validating the words that he says. Which is what really the Pharisees bring up in verses 11 through 13 of chapter 8, isn't it? Where they come to him and they say, you need to give us a sign from heaven to validate what you said about clean and unclean before you went off on your dirty Gentile mission. Right? They're saying you need to validate it with your miracle. But how else are we talking about how miracles sometimes function? Or how I was suggesting the deaf-mute miracle of chapter 7 is functioning. And how I even think that the blind man miracle we're going to be moving into is functioning as well. How else can they function? Yeah. We talked about with the healing of the deaf-mute, that it's kind of like a spiritual assessment of the disciples and the Pharisees at the time. Because the disciples are hearing the message of Jesus, but they're not hearing it. Right? They're seeing the things he's doing, like the deaf-mute. The deaf-mute could see, but he really couldn't hear and he really couldn't communicate what was happening. That the miracles, I do believe, are there to validate what he is saying. But I also believe, especially these two, really strange, unique miracles to Mark, are functioning in a literary way to point out how dense the disciples are or where they're at spiritually. And possibly even, I think also the Pharisees as well. Because what Jesus is presenting is something that is absolutely astounding. He's presenting a kingdom, a Jewish kingdom, that looks at the clean and clean, unclean issue that gives the Jewish people their identity. And he says, we're not doing it that way anymore. What actually makes you clean and unclean doesn't have to do with the food anymore. It has to do with what comes out of you. And they're saying that's a major shift. He says, yes, why don't you join me? The miracle we're moving in today is a weird one. It may be the weirdest miracle, not just in Mark, but maybe in any gospel. It's a very strange miracle. But I think that literarily it makes a lot of sense, especially in light with what becomes before it and what comes after it. And we'll get to that, obviously, by and by. Verse 22. They came to Bethsaida. Why is that significant? We've seen Bethsaida mentioned already. Where have we seen it? Maybe this would be a good in what chapter question, I think, maybe. Where's the first time we see Bethsaida? Think hard. It's been in the last two chapters. What's that? Cheat, friends. Look for it. I mean, you got a Bible, yeah? Where have we seen it? What's that?
He like walked on the water in the schism, and they went ahead to Bethsaida.
Right before he walks on water, right after the feeding of the 5,000 in chapter 6, verse 45, right? Immediately, Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to Bethsaida while he dismissed the crowd. Here's my question. Did they ever make it? No. What happened? The storm. And where did the storm end up? Where did they end up going when the storm blew them off course? To Gennesaret. And that's where we found the fruits of whose ministry? The Gerasene demoniac. Absolutely. So their initial goal of getting to Bethsaida never was reached. And then right after we have the interaction in the region of the Gennesaret, we go to the clean-unclean issue, then we go to Syrophoenician in the region of Tyre and Sidon, then we have the healing of the deaf-mute there as well, feeding of the 4,000, the Decapolis region. We've never made it to Bethsaida. And now, they came to Bethsaida. Finally, we made it. Normalcy is back. We've been derailed for two chapters. We've made it to Bethsaida. Well, Normalcy is not what I'll call what happens next. And some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. We've talked about this word begged. Well, let me say this real quick, though. I do think it's important to say this. Maybe kind of a, as Mark Moore would say, let's have a devotional moment for a second. Storms in your life will sometimes blow you off course. Remember I told you in Guatemala when this past summer, we had the gun pulled on us. 30 minutes in, we're investigating the sex trafficking of boys in Guatemala. We have a gun pulled on us, and it kind of rattled us. I mean, I was pretty open with you guys earlier this semester. What really rattled me the most was that night, my fear wasn't for my own safety. My fear was I was afraid that my kids were going to grow up without a dad. And that's what kept me out up all night. As I thought, man, and God used that to basically say, you think you have more control over your family than what you really do. I mean, do you really trust me that I'll take care of your family even if you die? And the next day, we were all kind of rattled, all of us. And we were like, you know what, we need to just kind of take a day. We're only here 4 days. But we need to take a day and just not really investigate in Guatemala City. We're going to go to Antigua, which is about a 2.5-hour drive away. It's more touristy. There's some really cool cathedrals there, some cool monasteries from the 1500s that are there, and there's some beautiful mountains. We're like, we're just going to go there and just kind of relax. So we go to Antigua, and it's actually the place where Roger Twitchell learned how to speak Spanish. So he's there, and he takes us to one of his favorite restaurants there, and they actually had, it was a jade museum. So we're just kind of going through and looking at the different jade. Jade is a fascinating, I guess, mineral or resource of some sort that they make jewelry out of. Has a really interesting history with the Mayans and stuff. So we're learning about all this. And all of a sudden, Roger, he didn't go on the tour because he's been on the tour like 20 times. So he was just hanging out talking to some of the people that he knew when he was in Antigua. Learning to speak Spanish. So we get done with the tour, and all of us sit down. It was just, you know, me and Wade Landers and a couple of other people, and we're talking, and all of a sudden Roger comes over and he says, you're never going to guess what just happened. And we were like, what? He's like, I just talked to my guy, and just randomly, in conversation randomly, he brought up the issue of sex trafficking in Antigua. And we were like, what, how did that come up? He's like, I have no idea. He's like, we weren't talking about what we were doing here. He's like, he just brought it up. He said, and apparently, the hottest area of sex trafficking is in this city. He said he gave me this address of the place to go. And so we ended up going to this different this ministry that was already there. And they were a ministry that over the region of Central America, they were housing 12,000 kids. Not just because of sex trafficking, but also because of human trafficking. The kids were the ones that would go out into the trash dumps. And they would be the ones that would be working for their slave master. That's the one that has kind of hold them hostage from their family. And we're talking to this guy, and our mind's just blowing because he's like, yeah, matter of fact, the past 4 years, we've broken up 2 sex trafficking rings right here in this city. And we all kind of went back, and that night we were reflecting on what had happened throughout the day. And this is what we did all came down to was, if it wasn't for the gun that was pulled on it yesterday, we never would have gone to Antigua. It wasn't on our radar. It was touristy. We weren't there for tourism. We were there to investigate sex trafficking. And God said, well, how can I get you to the tourist place? Whenever you have storms in your life, you have opportunities to react to them in different ways. Man, sometimes in ministry, they'll just be incredibly difficult storms. And you'll want to know the question, why? I thought we were headed this direction, Lord. Why all of a sudden does it feel like we're going this way? Or in your personal life, man, Lord, everything was going this way, but whenever this person died, now everything seems to be falling apart. Yeah, you may not have made it to Bethsaida, your key location. You may one day get there, maybe you won't. But ultimately, the route to get there is more important than the actual destination itself. Does that make sense? Because man, the whole clean, unclean issue that we've been ranting and raving about for about a week and a half now, it wouldn't have even hit the radar had the storm not blown them away. Storms in ministries happen all the time, and they're brutal. And I'm not going to make them trite or light of them. They're brutal. They hurt sometimes. But ultimately, if you really trust in who Jesus is and who God is, you'll end up at a Bethsaida. Does that make sense? You hear my heart in that? Hopefully it won't involve you having a gun pulled on you. That's freaky, man. I'm telling you, it's a weird moment. Okay. They came to Bethsaida, and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. The word begged, where have we seen it before? Yes, predominantly Gentile territory, which makes this one somewhat interesting, because Bethsaida, on the north of the Sea of Galilee, isn't really technically in Gentile territory. The Decapolis would be more down to the southeast of where we're at. But nevertheless, let's kind of trace theologically where this word pops up. You see it pop up in Mark chapter 5, verse 10 and 12. Whenever the demon-possessed man is begging Jesus for mercy. Please, it begs him. He pleads with Jesus, don't send us out of the region. Send us into the pigs. Then Mark chapter 5, verse 17, third time we see it. We see the people of the region beg Jesus to do what? Leave. Please leave. Why? Because a whole bunch of dead pigs are on our hands, and the Roman legions up to the north that have the pig as their symbol may not like that too well. Get out of here. We don't know what to do with you. Then the fourth time it's used in chapter 5, verse 18, where the demoniac, or the former demoniac at this point, begs Jesus, what? Can I please go with you? And what does Jesus say? No. And he doesn't tell him the messianic secret. He says the opposite. Go tell the people in the Decapolis all that the Lord has done for you. Go tell them. Then the very next time after that, it's in Mark chapter 6, verse 56, where we see the word beg. What is in Mark chapter 6, verse 56? We've already talked about it somewhat this morning already. There's begging going on there as well, but what is that context of begging? What's that? Yeah, it is predominantly are the ones that are coming from what region? And the region is the significant point.
Same one that he sent off.
Yeah. The same region, the same, maybe even the same people that were begging Jesus to leave just a chapter or two earlier. And now they're begging to do what? To touch the edge of his cloak. Because they probably heard the story of the woman that touched the hem of his robe, right? Because a story like that will spread. Now this is the very next time. Well, first of all, let's stop right there and ask this question. With the demoniac, the way he was begging initially, and the people they were begging initially, they were hearing the words of Jesus, but they weren't hearing them. They were seeing the words, they were seeing the actions of Jesus, but they weren't seeing them. And so the reaction, because they didn't know who he was please leave us. And then the very next time he comes to them, once they finally got it, Mark chapter 6, 56, their begging shifts. Their begging shifts. Now we know who you are. Please, let us just touch the hem of your robe. Your identity is clear, therefore now we truly can see. The next two times we see this word, the next time we see it is in Mark chapter 7, verse 32. Which is... Well, let's read it. Mark chapter 7, verse 32. There some people brought to him a man who was deaf and could hardly talk, and they begged him to place his hand on him, on the man. What's the issue? It's the miracle we just had that we talked about that literally was probably describing the way in which the disciples were hearing, but they weren't hearing. And then the very next time we see the word begged is right here in this miracle of the blind man, which I think is mirroring the same thing that's just been talking about the deaf mute. So let's put all this together. The Gerasene demoniac and the people of the region beg Jesus to leave because they don't know who he is and they're not understanding what they're seeing or what he's doing. The next time they get it because his identity is secure. 6:56, they get it. Please, let us touch the hem of your robe. The next two times it happens, I believe these two miracles are mirroring this exact progression. Except for this time, it's impacting the disciples and the Pharisees in the way they are seeing but not seeing, hearing but not hearing. I think Mark's linking some stuff for us. He's saying, pay attention to all the beggars because there's something happening here. They came to Bethsaida, and some people brought a blind man and begged Jesus to touch him. He took the blind man by the hand and led him outside the village. When he had spit on the man's eyes... Sorry, that image is just funny to me. Jesus is like, all right, come out here. You know, what are you going to do, Lord? You know, don't worry about it. Just, you won't be able to see anyway until I do it anyway, so it doesn't matter. He had spit on the man's eyes and put his hands on him. And Jesus asked, do you see anything? It's kind of a weird question, don't you think? Did it work? Did it work? It's even weirder the way the guy answers. He looked up and said, I see people. They look like trees walking around. What is he seeing? He sees people. They're looking like trees walking around. What's he seeing? Is he seeing people doing this? Maybe it's fuzzy. We've actually, with LASIK surgery, we've kind of learned a little bit more about what the healing process of an eye really goes through. It's pretty fascinating. My father-in-law had LASIK surgery. This was about 6 years ago or so now, 7 years ago. And he said for the next following week and stuff, he said, man, my vision was doing some weird stuff. There was even a couple day period that he said he was going through where everything was upside down. It was just, things were upside down. He was kind of freaking his head out. So a lot of times he was like, I just kind of, kept my eyes closed and just did what the doctor was telling me. Why? Because there's even a part of the mind that has to reorient itself of how to flip the image. What could this guy be seeing? If a bunch of people are walking like this and we're upside down, what does it look like? People upside down and their legs are going like this, almost like trees waving in the wind, I don't know if that's what he's seeing, but that seems to make some sense. It would make sense if what this guy sees is the whole world upside down. Because in a sense, what we're going to see in a minute, that's what the disciples are seeing. They can see the kingdom moving, they can see Jesus around, but everything is backwards. It's all upside down. It's not totally making sense to them. They see what they really don't see. The pieces aren't really coming together. There's a vague image that's happening there. But frankly, everything that they think that the gospel is going towards or the kingdom is moving towards, it's really upside down and backwards. So Jesus puts his hand on this guy and says, what do you see? Oh, I see people, but they look like trees walking around. Once more, Jesus put his hands on the man's eyes. Then his eyes were opened, his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. Before we get to verse 26, I want to just say very clearly what I think is happening here. And you can disagree with me. And bottom line is, I won't go to the cross for this interpretation, but I think that this could explain some of the things that's happening. Because there are several options that we come to this text, and we have to ask, what's going on? Right? Maybe it was Jesus' fault. Maybe that's what's going on. Maybe he's jet lagging a little bit from their boat trips. And he just kind of had a little short. Because his flux capacitor just wasn't up high enough. He just had to recharge a little bit. So it's going to take two shocks. Kind of like, what are those things called where you rub them together? Like one of those things. Maybe the first jolt just didn't really work. So he had to conjure up another one. Maybe that's what's happening. Maybe it's Jesus' fault. Probably not. It's kind of weird. Why would that be weird? Yeah. Because he's God, you doofus, standing in front of us. Yeah, that's a good answer. That's a real good answer. Also because, has that ever happened before? Where Jesus is like, man, sorry, that was a bad one. I just missed the target. Let me try again. No, it's not happened before. It'd be a weird thing. Maybe it's the man's fault. Now, that's somewhat happened before, hasn't it? Where can you think of where it seems to be that it's the people's fault of why the miracles weren't happening right? His hometown of Nazareth. Although if you look in Mark's gospel, it never really gives us a reason. It kind of alludes to one that Matthew makes most explicit. But it never really explicitly gives us a reason in Mark. But bottom line was, Jesus was not able to do the miracles in Nazareth. It was probably their fault. Matthew says he was shocked by their faith. Or their lack thereof. So maybe it's his fault. Maybe that man's flux capacitor wasn't high enough and his faith barometer just needed to go up another notch. And when he halfway saw, he was like, now I feel like something could happen. And then he was able, because of his faith, to be totally healed. What's wrong with that? Is there anything wrong with that idea? Yeah, it's kind of a weird thing. And normally that's not the way the miracles are really... I don't even think that's what was happening in Nazareth. Right? What is our definition of faith? I think I've said it more than once, right? What is our, everybody, what is our definition of faith? Not just Haley on the spot, but everyone. The acknowledgement and the submission to the identity and the power of Jesus. Right? The acknowledgement, submission to the identity and the power of Jesus. That is the way that faith seems to constantly work itself out. It's an identity issue. But here's the thing. Faith is not just like, you know, hoping really bad that, yeah, that Jesus may be able to do what you think He might be able to do. And because there's modern day implications for this type of theology, right? It's like when my mom had breast cancer whenever I was in high school. I did have some of my friends say, well, it's probably the reason why she's not being healed is probably because you guys don't have enough faith. It's like, wow, I mean, I think we're doing pretty good. But maybe not. Maybe we don't have the faith for her to be healed. That'll damage some people. You know, Mark Moore tells the story of whenever he was in Colorado. This would have been like 15 years ago or something. How old would you guys have been? Like five? Awesome. He's in Colorado, and these two, he said, well, the way he told it to me was two scrawny kids walked in. He said they kind of looked like you. And I was like, hey, man, what's that supposed to mean? But doesn't matter. But they come into this weightlifting room where Mark's in there. Mark's a pretty buff guy. He may hide it with his shirts, but he's a pretty buff guy, and he works out everywhere. So he's there, and he's getting ready, and he says he's watching them, and he said they put on, he said they may have weighed 115. He said, but they're putting on like 200 pounds worth of weight onto the bench press. And Mark's going, oh no, like what's going to happen? So Mark said he decided not to start lifting his next set because he thought I might have to help intervene here in a minute. He said the scrawniest kid gets down on the bench press. He lays down, and you know, the other kid, they both have to like struggle to help him get the bar up. He said he gets the bar up, and all of a sudden it just cracks down on his chest. He said you can hear an audible thud. He's back there, and he's scrambling. He's doing whatever he can to try to push it up. And his friend's behind him, and usually whenever guys are lifting, they think if they scream louder, it'll help the person lift it. Never understood that. It drove me nuts. Like, stop yelling at me. I feel like I'm at home. You know, the guy's struggling. He's like, come on, Johnny, come on. And then he says, you can do all things through Christ who gives you strength. And Mark said, at that moment, I thought, oh boy, whose fault is it whenever John doesn't get it up? Because at that moment, you actually have a theological quandary. And one of four things could be happening. Maybe Jesus said he could do it, but he really couldn't. He didn't have the power. Maybe Jesus really could do it, he just didn't want to because he's just kind of mean. Or maybe Johnny just doesn't have the faith in order to push that bar up. Or maybe that's just bad theology. That's the fourth option. And in this moment, we could opt that what's happening here is just bad theology. Well, we could use bad theology to interpret this text and say, it's this guy's fault. If his faith was higher, then his healing would have been one stage instead of two. Or, the option I've already kind of held my cards out here is, I think literally it's saying, this is spiritually where my disciples are at. This is where they're at. This is where the Pharisees are at. They're just seeing things upside down. And I think that's the option that helps them make the most sense theologically in Jesus' ministry and ultimately even the way in which Mark's been developing his gospel thus far. Verse 26, Jesus sent him home saying, don't go into the village. Does that surprise you? It's somewhat of a messianic secret there. You don't have the explicit don't tell anyone. But there is a directive in a negative sense that I think will be mirrored in the very next couple of verses. Verse 27. Jesus and his disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. Caesarea Philippi. I think it is more than appropriate that what happens next happens in this city for a couple of reasons. This was the capital city of Philip the Tetrarch, who was the Herod, one of the Herod the Great's three sons that takes over after he dies. This was this guy's capital city. As a matter of fact, this city's original name was Panias, which was named after the god Pan, and Pan was worshipped in the city. But whenever Philip took power, he wanted to show his allegiance to Rome in a way. And so he took this city and he beautified it, built it up, and renamed it, gave it a new name. Part of it was, in vain, his own name, Philippi. Can't help himself. And the other part of it was Caesarea, which would be another way of wrapping in whose name? Caesar. And I think it's very appropriate that we're going to be talking about here in just a minute, Jesus is going to be asking the question about His identity in a city that is named after the kings of the world. I don't think that's by accident. I think He walks into the city that has the name of the emperor, has the name of the person that even called, well, He didn't really call Himself, but He wanted to be king of the Jews, because His daddy was. And Jesus says, let's talk about My real name. Let's talk about who I really am. Jesus and His disciples went on to the villages around Caesarea Philippi. On the way, Jesus asked them, who do people say that I am? What kind of question is that? It's an identity question. We've not really changed topics all that much. We're still on the identity issue that we were whenever Herod Antipas was asking the question, who is this Jesus? And who did Herod Antipas think He was? John the Baptist. Which is exactly, we see a similar list right here than what we saw in chapter 6 with Herod Antipas. They replied, some say John the Baptist. Some do say that. Others say Elijah. And still others, one of the prophets. What are they saying about Jesus? Ultimately, there's a couple things that is happening here. Number one, they do think that the kingdom is near. That's what you can read from these people's descriptions of Jesus. They do think the kingdom's upon them. Because John the Baptist had a kingdom message, and a lot of them followed him because they thought he was going to establish a kingdom. And when he died, Herod Antipas and others said, maybe he's resurrected and that's a part of the kingdom. Maybe he's come back from the grave. Elijah has major kingdom implications, doesn't it? Think back to the first couple of weeks of class. Where is Elijah significant when it comes to the coming of the kingdom? He prepares the way. And what Old Testament book points us in that direction? That's exactly right. It rhymes with Malachi. Malachi. Chapter 3, verse 1, chapter 4, verse 5, right? Malachi says, see, I will send My messenger who prepare the way before Me. Then 4:5 says, see, I will send you the prophet Elijah. So Elijah coming means the kingdom's coming too. And this is interesting too. One of the prophets possibly goes to some Jewish intertestamental literature. 4 Ezra 2:18 says, talking about the establishment of the kingdom, God says, I will send you help, My servants Isaiah and Jeremiah. So when the people are saying, he's John the Baptist, he's Elijah, he is one of the prophets, what are they saying? He's a part of the establishment of the kingdom. But the major thing that they're saying is what? But he's not the Messiah. He's merely one of the forerunners. And that was something that was the key crux of the issue. They don't know who he is. He's just another prophet. Really, that's all he is. Just another prophet. A harbinger of the kingdom, not the king of the kingdom. And Jesus looks at him in verse 29 and says, but what about you? Who do you say that I am? Peter answered, you are the Christ. See the difference? You're not the forerunner of the kingdom. You're the king of this kingdom. In verse 30, Jesus warned them not to tell anyone about Him. And guess what? What's different about this messianic secret than the rest of them? Normally whenever a messianic secret happens, He says, don't tell them what happens. Yeah, they disobey Jesus and they tell. He tells the disciples here, don't tell, and what do? It looks like in the text that they obey Him. Okay, Jesus, we won't. That's kind of good. If the messianic secret puts us in a moral quandary in a sense. Jesus says, don't tell, and you're like, oh, can I disobey you and tell anyway? He looks at the disciples and He says, don't tell, and they say, oh, sounds good. I think that has something to do with the whole purpose of the messianic secret. But when will I tell you when that will be? Last day. We'll talk about the messianic secret the last day. It's just let it tease us all the way throughout the semester. We wouldn't have anything else to look forward to. Although the resurrection is something pretty important too, I think. Don't just get messed up in the messianic secret. Okay, verse 31. He then began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer. Son of Man, what kind of language is that? King language. Where does it come from? Daniel chapter 7. Yeah. I think that's the Son of Man language. And ultimately, in that language, verses 13 through 14 of Daniel 7, the Son of Man is the one that receives the kingdom that will reign forever and ever. And Jesus says, let me tell you how that's going to happen. He begins to teach that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders, chief priests, and teachers of the law. And that at that point, they're going, we've already seen that. I mean, the last six chapters, seven chapters have been full of stuff like that. He says, no, you don't understand. He must be killed. And after 3 days, he will rise again in the city, named after the king of the world. Jesus says, let me tell you how the true king of the world is going to win this war. There will be a moment whenever the weapons of the world and the weapons that I've come to wield will clash, and it's called the cross. But ultimately, the key weapon that I have to bring is after 3 days, I will rise again. Let's just see whose weapons win. In the city of Caesarea, I love that. That's not just irony. It's not just irony. That's politically explosive. You claim that you're a king inside of the city named after a king, you'll eventually get killed. That's just kind of the way it works. But ultimately, that weapon will be thwarted by Jesus' weapon. The ace up the sleeve, a little resurrection. Verse 32. He spoke plainly about this. He spoke very plainly. Notice what's being emphasized. You could hear this very clearly if you had ears to hear. He spoke very plainly about this. And Peter took him aside and began to rebuke him. You see, Peter sees, but he doesn't really see. You are the king. Yeah, you're right, I am the king. And the king's going to die and raise from the grave. No, you're not. But that's who I am. That is not who you are, because that's not who the Messiah is supposed to be. Peter, why doesn't Peter see clearly? Why is he just like the blind man that's seeing people walking upside down? What is Peter looking through? What lens? The Jewish apocalyptic lens. It says, my king is going to come. He's going to knock some people's heads together. Oh, he's not going to love his enemy. He's going to kill him. He's going to set us up in Jerusalem. And all the nations that put us under their foot, oh, they'll be under ours. And Jesus says, actually, I'm going to die. No, you're not. You're going to kill. No, I'm going to die. What's interesting is the word rebuke is really the word that we see in verse 30 where Jesus warns them not to tell anyone. He sternly tells them, do not tell anyone. And that's the same word when Peter comes across in verse 30. What is it? Verse 32. Peter says, that is not how it's going to happen. And then in verse 33, the same word is used again whenever Jesus turns and he rebukes Peter. So you have three rebukes that are happening. Don't tell anyone. Why? Because you, really, honestly, Peter shows why. Because you still don't really get it. You kind of do. You kind of see, but you really don't. Verse 33, but when Jesus turned and looked at the disciples, he rebuked Peter. Get behind me, Satan. Why would Jesus use such really strong language right there? Because he's still being tempted. What is the temptations of Satan all about? We see this more in Matthew's gospel than in Mark's, but what are they all about? Yeah. To change, if he's not supposed to have that kind of kingdom, it means you need to be a different king. It's an identity war. He's trying to get Jesus to be a Messiah that Jesus was not meant to be. He's saying, you want the kingdoms of the world to be subject to you, Jesus? Just worship me. That's all you got to do. You don't need a cross. Do you really need a cross, Jesus? I mean, you know what? I might save that for when we get to the Garden of Gethsemane. There's a video that I think is a really powerful clip of Satan tempting Jesus in the Gethsemane. Or not in Gethsemane, in the temptations. And one of the things in the video that we'll watch eventually, maybe if I can drum it up, is during the temptations, Satan starts taking Jesus throughout history. And people wearing the cross and moving across the worlds in their crusades. He says, this is what they're going to do with your cross if you take that route. And then he moves to different wars in the 20th century, and he says, they're fighting over the issue of Christianity. This is what you're dying for. Have a different kingdom, Jesus. You don't need a cross. This is what they'll do to it anyway. And Jesus knows who's behind what's happening here, because ultimately the issue of identity is something Satan's trying to get everyone to misunderstand. And Peter's bigotry caused him not really to be able to see what's going on the clean, unclean issue, because he didn't know who Jesus was. And the method of which Jesus will win, Peter can't really see, because ultimately he doesn't know who Jesus is. And what Jesus says is, clearly Satan's agenda is moving here. Jesus ends verse 33 by saying, "You do not have in mind the things of God, but the things of men." And what he's saying there is this. The things of men would say that the way I'm going to establish my kingdom is not through having violence taken upon me, but by doing violence to others. And he says, that's not the way that I roll. For the things of men, that makes good sense. That's how you fight wars. That's how you win. That's not how God's going to win through me. It's not how my kingdom's going to advance. It's going to advance through a cross. And Peter, you need to get on board, because, well, he doesn't say it here, but eventually one day Peter will have his own cross where he'll upside down hang on it. And in that moment, Peter gets it. It wasn't just then. I mean, he got it before then. But the way of the cross is not easy. It is foolishness to the Gentile, and it is a stumbling block to the Jews. But ultimately, the lowest of God's wisdom is higher than even our greatest heights. And therefore, I have no problem saying, yes, the cross is the way that this kingdom advances, even in the face of conventional wisdom, or political wisdom, or military wisdom. And ultimately, until we understand that, we'll be just seeing things upside down. I love you guys. See you Tuesday.